Our first case this morning is number 23-2608, Sun Valley Orchards against United States Department of Labor. Mr. Johnson?
Your Honor, should I come up here? But I can see Judge Smith from here. Can I turn this?
Sure.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Johnson for Appellant Sun Valley. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
The Department of Labor in this case imposed a $500,000 sanction on a multi-generation family farm, and it did that in the Department of Labor's own in-house agency court. These are courts where the prosecutors, the witnesses, and the judges were all employed by the same administrative agency.
Mr. Johnson, if I could interrupt from afar, because I'm sure all of the panel know the basics of this case. So I'd like to take a step forward and simply ask you this. For analytical purposes, can we read Jarkissi as providing something of a simple roadmap for how we resolve this appeal? And if so, in looking at that roadmap, don't we reach a crossroads which requires us to decide whether the action was fundamentally about immigration, which may suggest that it implicated public rights, or was fundamentally a labor dispute, which would suggest it implicated private rights? I don't mean to oversimplify, but is that one way of looking at this case?
I think that's basically right, Your Honor. I think that becomes the crux of the analysis. At the same time, I think that the question of whether this is about immigration or not about immigration may be oversimplifying or really just kind of misstating what the question is. And what I mean is that in Jarkissi, what the court said is that these public right exceptions have to have some limiting principle. And there has to be some way of binding them so that they don't, the exception doesn't swallow the rule. And the limiting
principle was emphasized throughout. It's an exception.
Absolutely. And the principle that the court adopted to limit these exceptions is history. And so I think the question is not just, is this case about immigration or is it not about immigration, but rather, does it fit within a historical exception to the Article 3 and the Seventh Amendment? And so the court did in Jarkissi indicate that there is a immigration-related historical exception, but it also talked about what that exception looks like. And it's specifically cited Ocean States, the Supreme Court's decision in Ocean Steam, excuse me, and it explained that in that case, it involved the movement, prohibition on the movement of a prohibited class of persons across the border, and then penalties that were enacted in order to enforce that prohibition. So I don't think the question is just,
administrative penalties?
Yes, Your Honor. That were enforced at the border by customs officials at the border.
And what do we do when the particular claims kind of sound in contract, like terms and conditions of employment, but the only reason the laborers are here in the first place is because of an immigration program, and they're only here temporarily pursuant to that immigration program?
Right. So I think that, again, what Jarkissi indicates is the question then becomes, is there a historical precedent for adjudication of that type of contract-based claim outside the Article III courts? And I think what I would submit to the court is that there is no such historical precedent, that the government has pointed to no historical precedent, that they're relying on this case. And frankly, there is no historical precedent, that the type of immigration adjudication that the older, sort of more early 20th century cases are talking about is adjudication of whether people should be in the country or at the very outside, as in Ocean Steam, the adjudication of penalties that are imposed at the border based on the movement of people across the border. And there's simply no precedent for the adjudication of contract type issues like the ones that are at issue in this case outside of the Article III courts. I assume
you would agree that facts matter here. And as Judge Porter has pointed out, The facts of this case are that the policy, the H-2A program, congressionally enacted, allowed potential employers to actively reach out somehow, whether it be by posting on an internet site or posting in a country where recruiting was being done, or both. So there was an active effort to encourage immigration, if you will, limited immigration into this country, was there not?
Well, I think that's right, Your Honor. Just a factual point I do want to emphasize is that some of the penalties, in fact, a large amount of the penalties in this case, were imposed based on Sun Valley's domestic workers. So of the $128,000 in back wages that were awarded in this case, 60,000 of those, and this is in the government's brief, 60,000 of those pertained to the domestic U.S. workers. And then for the penalties beyond that, the factual issues as to the domestic workers and the H-2A workers are the same factual issues. So the two are really inextricably interlinked. So,
yes, true. But for the H-2A program, the farm doesn't operate, though. You don't have the domestic workers. I think there were 51 domestic workers, 96 immigrant workers. And but for the program, the farm's not operating, correct?
Well, the farm had operated in years past without the program, and the farm made a choice. This was their first year entering into the program.
But that's the whole point, isn't it? Isn't that the whole point encompassed by Judge Hardiman's question? The program is utilized by employers or potential employers when there is not sufficient labor available in the United States. And yeah, Congress recognized that. Congress sought to strike a very careful balance here that would provide appropriate foreign labor where there was a lack of it domestically. And that balance included making sure that there was no disproportion in how foreign workers and domestic workers were treated, both in wage and other conditions. Am I right?
Well, I do think that this is a program that Congress enacted. I want to go back to the point about history. There's no indication that there's a history of that being something that supports non-Article III adjudication. Another point I want to make is it goes to remedy. And I think, you know, that type of consideration, the fact that this is a federal program, would, I think, be highly relevant if the remedy that the government was seeking was to disbar Sun Valley from that program. And absolutely, the question of whether Sun Valley should be allowed to participate in the program would be a question of public right that could be adjudicated by the agency. But the government's not seeking that remedy. They're seeking to impose penalties. And
all right, so you concede that if, because of the conditions at the farm, the government entered a debarment order against your client, that would be fine?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that all could be done within the auspices of the Department of Labor?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, and you know, I would say that
is the remedy dispositive?
I think
in these types of cases, not just yours, but in these types of cases?
I think it generally is, Your Honor. And I would point the court to Jarkissi, where there were issues there that could be viewed as public rights issues. So for instance, in addition to imposing penalties, the government had also barred Jarkissi and the associated investment companies from participating in the securities markets. And there's no question in Jarkissi that that was a matter of public right that could be adjudicated by the agency. And what the Fifth Circuit said was the Fifth Circuit analyzed whether that made it permissible to adjudicate it in the agency. And the court looked at the issues and said it's the same underlying factual issues.
Mr. Johnson, I heard you to say that remedies are dispositive. Or to answer Judge Hardiman, that remedies are dispositive here. The Jarkissi court did not say that, did they? And I'm trying to recall, and I don't have the specific language before me, but I'm trying to recall that if the Jarkissi majority opinion said something to the effect of the importance in the analysis of remedies here, I don't have it at my fingertips, but am I misrecollecting or am I recalling correctly?
What the court in Jarkissi said is that remedies are all but dispositive. And that was, you know, the fact that the government there was seeking penalties. And of course, the government, again, was seeking other remedies. So just like here, you know, here the government didn't even seek to debar Sun Valley. But even if they had, you know, if you look at Jarkissi, the fact that they were seeking to exclude Jarkissi from the securities industry, that was an issue of public right. But it did not transform the penalties into an issue that could be adjudicated in an Article III court. And I think the same is true here. Now, you're right, Judge Smith, they said all but dispositive. They didn't say dispositive, but the other things that they looked at also weigh in favor of Sun Valley here. They looked at, first, whether there was a common law analog, which there surely is here. And I think that is important. It shouldn't get lost because, you know, the government doesn't even contest that there's a common law analog.
This might be another way of asking the question that I asked earlier, but how can we so easily separate the sort of terms and conditions claims from the immigration context of this? Like, it's sort of immigration all the way down since it's the H-2A program. So maybe these claims are just all shrouded in immigration law. You know, they're not just sort of at some point pure labor or contract issues. How do we decide that?
Well, so I think the question I would ask is whether these penalties are being imposed based upon the movement of people across the border. And I think one way to look at that is that these penalties are all based on things that happened after people crossed the border. So for instance, a simple example, there's a penalty that was imposed because the tires on one of the trucks or buses were allegedly bald. You know, Sun Valley could have changed those tires after people crossed the border, and that penalty never would have been imposed. Similarly, with the kitchen access, you know, Sun Valley had a kitchen. You know, there's a dispute as to whether they offered kitchen access or not, but assuming that they didn't, they certainly could have. And that's, again, something that happened after people crossed the border. So, and another point I just want to make is that there
before you leave that point, Mr. Johnson, isn't it a possibility factually that while, as you point out, these violations, if you will, the conduct, if you will, certainly happened in the United States, might it also not be a theory of the complainants that in fact there were misrepresentations made as to what was to take place and what was to be offered and provided in the United States, and that misrepresentation would have been projected into and a part of the notice that went to the foreign workers? So the wrong would have been done, a wrong would have been done at the time of a misrepresentation.
Well, I don't think there's any legal requirement that these statements have been, assuming they were false, that the statements or representations be false at the time they were made. If Sun Valley had intended to provide kitchen access, but then had not provided kitchen access, that would support liability just as much as if they never intended to provide it in the first place. That's how I understand the Department of Labor's regulations. So I think this really is, it's not liability that is imposed based on statements that went to the eligibility of the workers to cross the border or statements that went to the sort of immigration aspect of this. These are things, the liability is imposed based on things that happened after the workers crossed the border. And I think, you know, it's important to note there are two agencies in this administrative scheme. There's the Department of Labor, which administers the domestic labor related aspects. And then there's Homeland Security. And there's two sets of paperwork. There's paperwork that goes to the Department of Labor, those forms that go to the Department of Labor, and there's a separate form.
So it's your view that if the Department of Homeland Security had inspected the premises and levied the fines and adjudicated the fines that you would lose?
Well, I don't think that the constitutional analysis turns on the agency, but I do think...
Well, then why did you just make the agency so significant?
Well, you know, I bring it up because my point is that this form is not even a form that is submitted to the agency that issues the visa. And so, you know, if it was the Department of Homeland Security that was here, I think it would certainly be a different case, a harder case. But the fact that we're just dealing with the Department of Labor, which doesn't even issue the visa, which doesn't even make the decision to allow these workers into the country at the end of the day, I think that makes it an even easier case.
Do you agree that if...
Go ahead. No, you meant Judge Porter.
Do you agree that if we decide the case on the Seventh Amendment issue, we don't need to reach the statutory authorization or the double removal protections?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree.
Mr. Johnson, I assume you acknowledge that there is at least language in Jarkissi. And I don't want to put too much weight on this. I want to know what import you see in it, if any, that there's at least language in Jarkissi that the public rights doctrine embraces matters concerning immigration. There's I think that looks back to Oceanic Steam. But if I'm right about that language, and note that I said just suggests, what should we make of that language? And if so, doesn't the H-2A program represent an exercise of Congress power over immigration?
Yeah, so 2 points quickly, Your Honor. One is that there is also language in Jarkissi that I think explains what that immigration exception encompasses. And specifically, the court says that Congress can prohibit immigration by certain classes of persons and enforce those prohibitions with penalties. And for all the reasons I've said, I don't think that's what is happening in this case. The other point I would make is that Jarkissi also talks about other types of exceptions. So for instance, there's a foreign commerce exception, there's a public lands exception, there's a benefits exception. But I don't think that that means that any case that touches on those issues in any way, shape, or form is a possible subject for agency adjudication. So take, for instance, foreign commerce. What the historical exception for foreign commerce encompasses is tariffs that are imposed at the border or other things like that. It doesn't mean that any article of commerce that has moved through foreign commerce can then anything pertaining to that article forever on, even if it occurs, you know, in the domestic market, can be adjudicated by non-Article III courts. And you can see, you know, if that wasn't the case, just like the Interstate Commerce Clause essentially has, you know, become a blank check for legislation, the Foreign Commerce Public Rights Exception would become a blank check for non-Article III adjudication. I hope that makes sense. And my point is that the government's approach here of just does it somehow relate in some way to this field of things that are out there that are named an exception. That's not a limiting principle of the sort that the Supreme Court has said is required. And again, to come back to where I started, the limiting principle that the court adopted is history. And there is just no history of the adjudication of this type of contract-related issue. I see I'm over my time.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you.
Mr. Aguilar?
May it please the court, Daniel Aguilar for the Department of Labor and the Secretary of Labor. Opposing counsel agrees that Sun Valley actively encouraged foreign laborers to come to the United States. That's how the H-2A program works, right? If there's a determination that there are insufficient amount of domestic workers to perform the temporary agricultural work, the employer purposefully goes to the federal government and says, I would like to import foreign laborers here for a particular time. And Congress struck a balance between allowing employers access to that foreign labor and preserving the domestic market for workers.
All right, so you have but for causation. But for the program, the laborers aren't here, and then they don't suffer the conditions that resulted in the fines.
I think it's a bit more than that, Your Honor. It is that if Sun Valley had come forward and said, we're going to make all of these offers on the job offer that we have to make to the local domestic force, and then that's the same job offer that gets posted for the foreign laborers, right? But actually, we're going to materially change the terms of these conditions.
Well, that would be fraud.
And
they could be sued for fraud.
But it's maybe there's some fraud down on the lower level, right? And obviously, there are some common law claims in the immigration context, right? Marriage fraud or the like. But I think here the key part is that if the federal government had known that actually the carefully constructed balance that Congress and the executive enacted to maintain this program and strike a balance between immigration and the domestic market was actually going to be willfully subverted by an employer, these foreign laborers would
Well, we don't know whether they this. We don't know whether they intentionally subverted or after the workers got here decided they didn't want to spend the money. That's not really part of the record either way. We just know that the conditions were not consistent with the job order, correct?
And that's the key part, right, is that they have to be consistent with that, because what the job order is doing is saying we're going to pay this prevailing wage rate. We're going to offer this particular kind of housing.
There were terms and conditions in the job order.
And that's...
And that was a contract.
And no, that's actually set up by statute.
The job order is not a contract.
The minimum terms that they have to provide are set up by statute. It's part of a contract that then goes out
but to the workers. But there wasn't a contract in this case?
I'm saying there is a contract. I'm saying these particular terms, though...
I'm not asking the provenance of the terms. I'm asking whether there was a contract here.
Yes, I agree with you there's a contract.
And they violated the contract.
They violated the contract. And the reason that the provenance matters, Your Honor, though, is because that is coming from choices that Congress made about how to regulate the immigration here, right?
Well, but I mean, let's look at foreign commerce as an analogy, right? There's a public rights exception for foreign commerce, right?
Yes.
Okay, but if somebody is engaged in human trafficking in foreign commerce, they can't be administratively charged, convicted, and punished for that. What happens is there's a federal indictment, and then there's a jury trial in this courthouse.
Sure.
So saying that it's foreign commerce and that there's a foreign commerce public rights exception doesn't get you a victory. There needs to be something more. So too in the immigration context, because Congress regulates who comes in and out of the country, doesn't mean that there's not a right to a jury trial in this case, right? And under Jarkissi, don't we look to the fact that there was a contract, and because contract is not a public right, it's a private right, this case seems to be a lot like Jarkissi. Mr. Jarkissi didn't have a right to trade securities, but for the establishment of a heavily regulated securities industry. And the farm in this case didn't have a right to employ the foreign workers, but for a congressional scheme that allowed for their entry into the country. So I see a lot of parallelism here, and I'd like you to explain why this case is different.
Sure. So I think there is a meaningful distinction between Jarkissi in this case, which is what motivates the Supreme Court's analysis and what the Supreme Court relies on in large part. So just to one set up the framework here. Jarkissi is a Seventh Amendment case. So it first asks, what is the cause of action involved? Is it a common law action? Because that's what the Seventh Amendment speaks to. And Judge Smith, this goes to your question about, is the remedy dispositive? There, the Supreme Court...
You get to remedy, oh, sure. stick with common law right, contract. In Jarkissi, the common law right was fraud,
yeah,
correct?
Yes.
Or the common law cause of action was fraud.
Yes.
Here, it looks to me like the common law cause of action, it sounds in breach of contract.
And so what that gets you is the Seventh Amendment implicated?
Yes.
And so then you move on to the second part of the analysis, which Jarkissi does, which says, okay, even if the Seventh Amendment is implicated, is this a private right or a public right?
All right. And you concede the Seventh Amendment is implicated?
Yes. Okay. That's
all right. So this case is all about whether it's part of the public rights exception or not. And it is an exception. Correct.
I agree it's an exception. And what Jarkissi is saying is, you know, you look to what the securities laws there were doing. They didn't create something new. There was a pre-existing market between individuals to buy and trade securities. And then what they said, what Congress did in enacting the Securities Act and the Exchange Act was basically take the common law doctrine of fraud, root and branch, and stick it into federal statutes, and then expand upon that and make civil penalties in new fashion later that could be adjudicated in administrative proceedings. But drawing on the common law of fraud, drawing on the particular transactions, and placing the SEC in the shoes of a defrauded investor. And that's why the court said, that's not a matter of public rights, the US government working as a sovereign within this well understood exceptions, that's a matter of private rights. Jarkissi notes there's not a clear distinction all the time. So there's going to be a gray or fuzzy area in between. But then it goes out of its way to identify core public rights. And one of those that it identifies is for foreign commerce, and it cites the oceanic steam navigation and over that of immigration. And I think this is why the analysis is helpful for looking to oceanic steam navigation. It's one of those cases that has the plaintiff's arguments written out at the beginning of the Supreme Court decision. And it's at pages 323 to 324 of that decision, that there the plaintiffs in Oceanic Steam Navigation make the same arguments that plaintiffs are making here. That yes, Congress has a public right over immigration, and yes, it can do certain things about that, but this is really a matter of private rights. This is really taking our property and doing something that was not happening at the border. It's about a medical inspection that's happening elsewhere pre-ante. And what the Supreme Court says, it's two pages, it's at 339 and 340, is the Supreme Court rejects that kind of delineation. It says, no, this is a matter of public rights. What you're really asking is this really necessary to effectuate all of what Congress has legislated in this area of immigration? And that we are unwilling to do. We're not going to slice and dice here. But, now, I take-
But Oceanic Steam, though, it is really about who gets to cross the border. And that's all it's about, right? And can the government fine people for letting in the kind of aliens that we don't want to let in? It's about who gets to enter at the border. Beyond that, like where we are now, downstream at the working, you know, at the farm, Oceanic Steam doesn't seem to address that sort of question.
Agreed that the facts are different. As to the United States' authority on immigration, I think it's a little doubt that somebody who enters the country on a visa, stays in Kansas for the entire time, overstays the visa, or forges green cards in order to gain work authorization without leaving, even though that's happening with the interior, that's a violation of the immigration.
Yes, and that person could be removed without a jury trial. But if that person is charged with fraud,
that's the Ninth Circuit.
Maybe that same person, while they're pending removal from the country, is going to be criminally prosecuted in a federal court in front of a jury for fraud.
And so criminal prosecutions are obviously different, right? That's governed by the Sixth Amendment.
Maybe the person who was defrauded by the fraudulent green card brings a civil action, and that same person would get a civil jury, no?
Or tort.
Yeah, that person, right. The person runs somebody over while they're pending removal.
Right. And we're not arguing that the mere fact that immigration might be involved gives you a jurisdictional hook to go into all of these areas. But I think the Ninth Circuit's decision in Noriega Perez, where the immigrant did falsify green cards and did falsify SSA documents and then was civilly fined in an administrative proceeding, the Ninth Circuit there had no trouble saying that's a matter of immigration rights and Congress can constitutionally set up that system, rejecting an Article III challenge. So here—
And what were the misdeeds again?
Falsifying green cards, falsifying SSA documents.
All right, but those, right. But those misdeeds are an affront to the system, the immigration system. Here, the misdeeds are breaches of contract. They are about conditions of housing. They're about labor conditions, working conditions. The fines, as I understand it in this case, are a laundry list of misdeeds, all of which were, we had a deal and you breached the deal, and you breached the deal in multifarious ways, including upcharging for water, squalid housing conditions, bald tires. Those are all breaches of the deal. Those aren't an affront to the regulatory scheme.
When Congress enacted this version of the H-2A program in 1986, it did so in a chapter called Reforming Legal Immigration. I think the deal that Your Honor is talking about, you could think of one kind of deal of with a particular immigrant laborer and how that affects them. There's also a deal that they made with the federal government, because Congress set out a balance on, we want this employer to access foreign labor that they otherwise wouldn't.
That's why I asked your friend whether the fact that this whole thing begins with the H-2A program, does it mean that everything that happens thereafter is shrouded in immigration? Or is there at some point at which we can begin to forget about the immigration aspect of it and just say, look, this is a breach of contract. This is like the ALJ's opinion says numerous times that this was a breach of contract. Here's one example. The express terms of the job orders - the employment contracts between the farm workers and respondent - were clearly not in line with the realities facing the farm workers upon arrival at the dormitory. Respondent, therefore, right, because of these breached contracts, violated 20 CFR section 655 and et cetera. So are we necessarily dealing with immigration all the time these people are here?
I'm not going to say necessarily all the time with people are here. Again, I can see how that could get into a hook to other things. But I think what Your Honor is getting at is these just seem to be contracts. And so doesn't that just make this a common law claim? And the reason that that's not true, if I can, just to explain here, Congress was very much concerned about preserving the domestic labor force and making sure that hiring foreign laborers was not going to adversely affect the wage rate. That's why the Department of Labor is put in charge of this, is because they have the particular expertise about making sure what the wage rate is, the particular benefits, et cetera. When somebody is violating the job order, and again, most of those provisions from the job order either come from the statute 1188 or come from the implementing regulations that Congress directed labor to enact. When they're violating those terms, what that effectively does is depresses the effective wage that they're paying out, and then subsidizes the farm by using foreign laborers that they otherwise would not have access to the disadvantage of the domestic labor force. And so unlike a system where the SEC is coming in and saying, you have defrauded these people, that's a harm to them, and I care about it, this is the federal government saying, Congress set up a particular balance between domestic and foreign labor, and what you're doing is disrupting that to the detriment of U.S. workers by accessing foreign laborers, and that's a harm to the sovereign about what kind of decisions we make about who can enter this country and what work they can do.
I think everything you say there is indisputable. I'd be curious to hear if Mr. Johnson disagrees with any of that, but I'm not sure it answers the question, because the integrity of the program and bad behavior by a farm or company that participates in the program could obviously lead to debarment. But we're not dealing with a debarment case. We're dealing with something that looks a lot like a breach of contract case.
And so I take that also to be an additional concession that plaintiffs are making here, is debarment's a matter of public right, is what I understood him to be saying. And I don't think that that's contested. If that's a matter of public rights, that participation in the program and compliance with it can result in debarment, and that can be done administratively, what Oceanic Steam Navigation, JARCISI, all of these cases additionally make clear is that when you're operating within that public right realm, you can also impose a civil penalty, because at that point you are within public rights, and that is the kind of thing for which Congress can allow a civil penalty to be imposed. That's why in Oceanic Steam Navigation, they were allowed to fine the steamship company, and that wasn't a problem under Article 3. You could have also prohibited them from bringing future immigrants into the country. That could be done administratively. But the Supreme Court additionally explicitly upheld a fine.
Let me ask you a counterfactual. Let's assume the 90 immigrant laborers were all housed, fed, and worked in perfect conditions, consistent with the job order. And let's assume that the 51 domestic workers were housed in squalor, had to work an extra 2 hours a day, were upcharged for water, and transported in unsafe vehicles. Can the DOL fine the domestic workers?
So when it
can the DOL do the exact same thing that it did in this case to the domestic workers?
I want to preface this with, obviously, that's a different factual scenario, and we need to think about that a bit more. But on the spot, what I think that's doing is still, you're getting access to this increased foreign labor to still perform the work. And overall, you're effectively decreasing the wages that you're paying to everybody. And that's the same concern that Congress had. It wasn't necessarily, are you going to pay a dollar less to the immigrant and the effective wage to the domestic worker, or a dollar less to the domestic worker and the same rate to the immigrant? It's applying for all to try to make sure that the domestic market holds steady while also allowing access to increased wages. So to the extent that these statutory and regulatory violations are acting against Congress's interest in controlling the immigration market, I think the answer would ultimately come out the same.
Mr. Aguilar, yes, Your Honor. The line drawing in this case is, for me, in any event, a very difficult exercise. And ask you a rather general question. Does the Supreme Court's consistent historical definition of the immigration power as the power to exclude certain classes of immigrants inform our analysis here of whether the public rights doctrine should apply to this case?
I think it obviously informs the analysis. I think the way that it informs it is, one, I think it's uncontested between the parties that obviously you can engage in removal or exclusion proceedings and certain proceedings at the border. I think, two, for the reasons that we've explained here, it also extends to additional claims that are attached to that deeply. Instead of being used as a jurisdictional hook, if you are permitted to enter the country by making certain promises that you're going to only engage in this temporary work, right? If an H-2A laborer exceeds that work, works for someone else, overstays their visa, that's a violation of the terms. They can also be excluded or potentially fined if they violated some part of it. So too for the employer who voluntarily asked the United States for permission to import certain peoples and made assurances that it would comply with the program that Congress enacted in that area. We're not going so far afield as to try to regulate common law, tort, and property claims wholly outside of this, but these are the ones that are strictly attached to the terms and conditions by which people may enter the country. I'm happy to answer any other questions. I know there are other issues in the case, but obviously this is obviously the focus of attention.
Anything further, Judge Smith?
No, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Aguilar.
Thank you.
Rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to pick up on this question of line drawing. And I think that Jarkissi draws two clean lines in this area. And the first is the line of remedy. And I think it's the primary line. It's all but dispositive. And I think I want to be clear about something. I think it takes care of the vast majority of immigration-related non-Article 3 adjudications, because most of what administrative judges, you know, especially IJs, are immigration judges are doing involves adjustment of status. And there's no question that adjustment of status, the decision to allow someone in or out of the country, is a issue of public right that can be adjudicated outside the Article 3.
What about your friend's argument that there were monetary fines imposed in Oceanic Steam?
Right. And so I think that then brings, I think, to the second line drawing principle, which is the history. And so the court indicates there are these narrow exceptions, for instance, in Oceanic Steam, but they have to be confined to narrowly to a concrete historical practice. The historical practice at issue in Oceanic Steam was vastly different from here. There it was not a contract issue. It wasn't something that occurred after the people had crossed over the border. It was a penalty that was imposed, as the court said in Jarkissi, it was imposed at the border based on the movement of people, a prohibited class of persons across the border.
Okay, but that does suggest, doesn't it, that the remedy might not carry the day as much as you suggested before, because there it wasn't debarment alone. It was the same sort of monetary penalties that you're looking at here.
Yeah, I think the point I just wanted to make is that to the extent there's any concern that immigration work more broadly would have to all come into the Article III courts, that simply there's no question that if the remedy is to exclude someone from the country or debarment, you know, whatever the issues are in the case, that's a question of public right. The hard cases, to the extent there are hard cases, are cases that involve penalties. But there, what the court indicated is that the presumption is in favor of the Article III courts. The exception to Article III adjudication has to be an exception, and there has to be a limiting principle. And I think
what is the limiting principle?
Well, exactly. And I think the limiting principle is.
Well, you need to tell us.
I think the limiting principle. The limiting principle is history, Your Honor. I think the.
And what is history? History. That's, you know.
The government.
They teach entire semesters of that. So you need to put some meat on that bone, I think.
Absolutely. And I think the government needs to come forward with evidence. So the exception is an exception. And the government, to overcome the presumption in favor of the Article III courts, needs to come forward with evidence of a historical practice that is in line with what they are doing here.
Like we're doing in Bruin in the Second Amendment cases.
I think it's similar, Your Honor. And I think the government hasn't even tried to make that type of a showing here. There's just the government.
It doesn't have to be a twin, but it has to be a relevant analog, right?
There has to be something that's close enough to what's going on here that the court can say this is within that.
Give us an example of something that would have been close enough that would cause you to lose this case.
Sure. So I think, you know, Ocean States is obviously a little recent, but obviously the court is treating Ocean States as a historical practice, even though it's from 1909. If this was the type of penalty that was at issue in Ocean States, I think there's no question that would be within the exception. If it was,
what would that penalty have looked like in this case? Just suss out for us how it would have happened in a way that would make you concede that it was close enough to an historical precedent to not require a jury trial.
I think if Sun Valley had made misstatements that went to whether these people were allowed to come across the border or not, in order to bring them across the border when they shouldn't come across the border. So,
So the 90 workers all have fake names and fake, they're just not who they say they are.
Yeah, I think that would be, I think that, for instance, would fall within the scope of the Ocean States exemption.
And your client could have been fined for that?
So what I'd want to know is the fine being imposed based on the movement of the workers across the border? But yes, it sounds...
Yeah, it's for example, we're going to fine you, the government's going to fine you $10,000 per worker because instead of encouraging 90 farm workers into the country, you encourage 90 terrorists to come into the country.
That to me sounds like something that would fall within the Ocean States exception. And of course, we're very far from that here. And for a number of reasons. One, because this is something that happened in the country after the people crossed the border. The other is because of the common law analog. You know, Ocean States didn't involve this type of common law analog. It also didn't involve back wages, which I think is an important point. It's just a case of a penalty. So there's no suggestion there's any...
Yeah, you made much of that in your briefing, that the monies aren't even going to the victims. Or the wronged parties that suffered the breach of contract.
Well, so the money.
Why is that an important distinction? If the orders here required that compensation be paid to the workers who suffered the harm as a result of the breaches of the job order.
So the money is paid to the government, and then the workers, in theory, can apply for it. The Department of Labor has a historically bad track record of actually telling people that they're entitled to these funds and actually turning them over. But in theory, these workers could apply and could actually be paid these funds.
It really doesn't matter.
Yeah, well, I think if anything, the fact that these back wages, it just, again, underscores the contract-like nature of these claims, that these workers could apply for these funds, they could be paid them. And these are really, I think, amount to contract damages, although they're paid in the first instance to the government. And again, to the point of history, there's no historical precedent of judges. You know, the Ocean States case, for instance, doesn't involve the adjudication of contract-like damages. And I think, you know, on this question of limiting principles, the government suggests not.
Well, Mr. Johnson, Oceanic Steam did involve a civil penalty, did it not?
Yeah, it did involve a penalty.
And, yes. And that doesn't help you, does it?
Well, my point, Your Honor, is that to the extent the government...
Isn't that a historical analog?
To a penalty of the sort that's at issue in Ocean States. But my point in the issue of remedy is that that case did not involve back wages. And the government has not come forward with any precedent that it points to support the award of back wages in this case. Nor really do I think the Ocean States precedent supports the award of penalties here either. There's no historical precedent that they point to support the idea that the government could adjudicate these contract type issues simply because they involve a worker who at one point crossed the border. And again, the government says that they're not arguing that they can adjudicate everything a green card.
But the big distinction you're making in your briefing, as I recall, is that was a people coming into the country case. It was assessed at the port. There was a problem right at the port of entry in Oceanic Steam, correct?
Yes, and it was also a problem at the port of entry that involved a prohibition on coming across the border and a violation of that prohibition.
All right, so here, if the migrant workers in this case had been vetted at the border and it had been determined that they weren't who they said they were and that your client was complicit in that, your client could have been hammered with fines. They could have been excluded at the border, and your client could have been hammered with fines for its complicity in defrauding the program.
At
the border.
Yeah, that to me sounds like it would fall in the Ocean Stakes exception. Yes, Ocean Steam exception.
And everything changes because once they end up in New Jersey, it's a workers' rights case rather than an immigration case. Well, getting back to where we started with Judge Smith's initial question, is that what we have to decide, that this is a workers' rights case rather than an immigration case for you to prevail?
So again, I think sort of, but I think that that slightly twists the question. I think the question is whether this case falls within the historical exception that the Supreme Court recognized in Oceanstein. And, you know, I think that's a similar question, but it's also a different question.
So a little piece of the fines might fall in the within the exception, even if the majority of it doesn't. So if the back wages and so on are sort of contract sounding claims, the some of them are sort of like $10,000 worth of the fines were for what I would characterize as sort of building code violations or purely regulatory, that, you know, the driver didn't have the right driver's license. Do we split those off? Do we just lump them in with the contract sounding claims? What do we do with the ones that aren't so obviously sort of common law sounding?
Yeah, it's a good question, Your Honor. I do think, again, that those claims, they are penalties. And so what the Supreme Court in Jarkissi, drawing on Tull, suggested is that penalties have to be adjudicated in Article III courts, that historically a common law, an action to impose penalties was an action at common law.
And was there a common law action for having the wrong screens or having the wrong driver's license?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor, but that was, so this goes back to Tull, where, you know, Tull was a case for a violation of environmental regulations. And what the court said, you know, there was no analog to some environmental regulation,
yeah,
but it was nonetheless a common law type case, because at common law, if the legislature enacted a penalty and then you sued to collect that penalty, that was an action at debt at common law. And I think that would, same reasoning would apply here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, counsel, for both sides. The court will take the matter under advisement. We're going to take a brief recess while the next case is getting set up.